Shalom. Welcome to the Jewish Task Force, JTF. My name is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to refuah shlema, a complete recovery for Sharon Katz, and to elevating the souls of Simcha Bat Rachel, Pesach Zev Ben Chava, Harav Mir Kahana, Yosef Ben Meir, Bari Hoffman, Ruven Hoffman, Robert Mittman, and Sipora Fegi Bat Liba. We have a lot of subjects we want to cover. We want to discuss Parashat Vayishlach, which is this week's Torah portion, and there are three different aspects that we want to cover, so we're going to have to try to go through it as quickly as possible. And if we have time, we want to discuss the massacre of over 300 Muslims by their fellow Muslims in a mosque in the Sinai that occurred last week. We want to discuss the implications of that and what that tells us about the Islamic world and Muslims and coexistence with Muslims. And finally, we want to discuss the case of Ivan Dimanyuk, Yimach Shmo V'Zechro, Ivan the Terrible. It's a very difficult case to discuss, a case of someone who was one of the most brutal Nazi war criminals of the Holocaust, and he was acquitted by the self-hating Israeli Supreme Court. We want to go into detail about that if we have time in this program. Let's see how quickly we can go. If we have time, we'll try to do the Dimanyuk case this week. If not, we may have to do it in a future program. Let's start off with this week's parasha. In this week's parasha, Yaakov Avinu, Jacob our father, Yaakov Avinu, struggles with an angel. Some refer to him as an angel. It says, Ha'ish, im ish. Ish just means a man or a person. It doesn't say angel in the Torah itself. The actual language doesn't say angel. Some of the rabbis interpret his struggle as a struggle with an angel. Some say it's the angel in charge of Edom. Edom is Rome and the Western world and the angel in charge, and they claim that he struggled with that angel. But I'm interested in a different interpretation. There's another interpretation that some rabbis have, that some of Chazal have given us, and it's the interpretation that I usually follow, because you know I usually follow the very rational line of thinking in Torah Judaism. Now, I believe in Hashem with perfect faith. I believe in the God of Israel with absolutely perfect faith. I believe that every letter and every word in the Torah is absolutely perfect and divinely inspired. And I believe that the entire world is completely controlled by Hashem, by God, and that our destiny is in the hands of Hashem, and that everything we do should be guided by His Torah, by the mitzvot and the laws that He has given us. So I believe in all of that with perfect faith, but I also believe that there are deeper meanings to many things that are written in the Torah being the first five books of the Bible. There are many deeper meanings there that we have to understand. And there are many, just as there are many deeper meanings to the Tanakh is the Bible, the Jewish Bible as a whole. So the interpretation that I go by and that quite a few rabbis have given, is that Yaakov, who was Yaakov struggling with? It says he was struggling with a man. All night long he struggled with him. Who was he struggling with? He was struggling with himself. This was a struggle with himself. He was struggling with his own Yetzer Hara, with his own evil inclination. And of course, every human being has the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination, and the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. And what was he struggling about? He was struggling about his decision to obey Hashem's commandment to go to Eretz Yisrael, to go to the land of Israel, to leave Haran and go to the land of Israel. Because Yaakov Avinu was in the exile. He was in the Galut, in Haran, with Lavan, his uncle. And he had a family. He built a family there. He married Leah and Rachel. He married two women there. He already had 11 sons, and Rachel was pregnant with the 12th son, with Binyamin. And so he had a large family. And he had a great deal of wealth that he accumulated in Haran. In Haran, he was very wealthy and very comfortable. And they had a good life there. And he had a big family there. And they had relative security there. So he had all of these benefits and advantages. And he was familiar with the life in Haran. He had been there for 20 years. He was familiar with the life that you lead in Haran. But it was not Eretz Yisrael. It was not the land that Hashem wanted him to be in. So he was told by Hashem, I want you to go to Eretz Yisrael. I want you now to return to Eretz Yisrael. And when he understood that, he had to. It was a struggle to decide to make Aliyah. There was a struggle there. Aliyah means immigrating to Eretz Yisrael, going up to the land of Israel. Why was it a struggle? Because in Eretz Yisrael there were tremendous dangers for him and his family. I mean, of course, Yaakov, like any decent, normal father and husband, loves his wife. In this case, his two wives. He loves his wives. He loves his children. He loves his family. God forbid, he would never want any harm to come to them. He doesn't want to put them in danger. And here, Esav, his twin brother, was waiting to murder him with hundreds of soldiers waiting to murder him. And there were many other dangers in Eretz Yisrael. Whereas in Haran, he was relatively safe. So it was a case of putting himself and his family in physical danger by following this commandment to go to Eretz Yisrael. In addition to that, in Eretz Yisrael, there was tremendous economic insecurity and instability in those days. Tremendous economic instability. Avraham, Yaakov's grandfather, was forced to go to Egypt because of the starvation and the famine that existed in Eretz Yisrael because there was a drought. There were frequent droughts in Eretz Yisrael at that time. And Yaakov himself would later also be forced to go to Egypt. When his son Yosef was the viceroy of Egypt, he would eventually, Yaakov and the whole Jewish people, represented at that time by Yaakov and his sons, they would be forced to go to Egypt. And so there was economic instability. And his family would be subjected to economic instability and the prospect of droughts and famine and other things. Tremendously difficult decision to go there. So there was physical danger, economic instability, and the possibility of even famine and droughts. And third, Avodah Zarah, there was tremendous idolatry. The people in Eretz Yisrael were all idolaters. Now it's true that in Haran they were also all idolaters, but Yaakov had carved out a little area for him and his family where he could raise his family, and they could be more shielded maybe from the idol worship, from the influences of Avodah Zarah, of idol worship. In Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, who knows? Maybe they'd be influenced by the idol worshippers. So there were a lot of reasons why he would not want to make Aliyah. It's, you know, as the American Jews who don't want to make Aliyah would say, it's dangerous, what am I going to do? They blow up everybody, you know. They blow up buses, they murder people, they stab people. And those things really do happen in the land of Israel. Of course, in my view, it's a lot less dangerous to live there I think it's just as dangerous to live in the United States. The crime rate in the United States is higher than it is in the land of Israel. But that's besides the point. This is a similar situation to what we see today with the difficult decisions of people who want to make Aliyah today. Is it dangerous to live in Israel? The economic instability, how am I going to get a job? How am I going to support my family? I'm economically secure living in Brooklyn or Queens or Los Angeles or whatever other community Jews happen to live in. Why would I leave economic security and living in a beautiful home and driving a beautiful car and having my kids go to schools where they're happy, and the religious Jews that live here, and having my kids go to yeshiva, and I'm going to give that up and go to Israel with this economic insecurity, and I don't speak the language, and many other issues that come up? You know, it's a very difficult decision to make. Although it's still to show the indictment against this generation, unfortunately, what an easy decision it is compared to the challenges that Yaakov faced. Yaakov faced an enemy, Esav, with hundreds of soldiers waiting to slaughter him and his family. So he faced a much greater danger than some Jew just going on Aliyah now in the land of Israel, in the state of Israel. Certainly the average Jew in the state of Israel is a lot safer than Yaakov was in that situation. And Yaakov had to struggle with that decision. What do I do? I mean, I don't want to put my children and my family in danger. I don't want them to starve or to be part of it, be in a drought. Right now they're secure. They have lots of. We're wealthy. We're secure. We're affluent. We're living in Haran. Why put my children and my family in that danger, in that situation, when we don't have to? When we could live. He could always make the excuse. We could have a yeshiva here and the shul here and a beautiful life here and a nice community here. And we could follow the mitzvot of the Torah here in Haran, even though it's not Eretz Yisrael, even though, by the way, the majority of the 613 mitzvot, the 613 commandments in the Torah, can only be performed in the land of Israel. The majority of the mitzvot only refer to, can only be done in the land of Israel. In any event, and by the way, we're required to do the mitzvot when we're in the Galut, as preparation for the land of Israel. The mitzvot are intended, all the mitzvot are intended, and our whole life and our whole existence as Jews is intended for our lives in Eretz Yisrael, not in the Galut, not in the exile. Galut is exile, not to live in the Galut. We're required to do the mitzvot when we're in the Galut, but that's only as training and preparation for doing the mitzvot in Eretz Yisrael. Because the real purpose, the real goal is to perform all the mitzvot in Eretz Yisrael. So he struggles with this, and in the end he wins the struggle, it says. He prevails. And he prevails against the man or the angel or however you want to interpret it. He really prevails against his own inner demons that are telling him, oh, don't do it, it's not safe, it's not practical. You know, what do the Jews in our generation always say? Be practical, be practical. Or I'm a pragmatist. You know, this is what they always say, which is a way of saying, I don't have faith, I don't believe. Now, of course, in Judaism we don't have blind faith, but it's not blind faith to believe that when you do what Hashem commands you to do, that things are going to turn out the right way, that Hashem is the ruler of the world. That is the true practical view. That is true practicality. And I'm not saying people should make aliyah when they're unprepared. People should learn Hebrew, as much Hebrew as they can learn. They should be prepared. They should have an economic plan with what job will await them, and do they have a plan for getting a job, and how exactly do they plan to do the aliyah. They should have a realistic plan in place. That's true. But they shouldn't be so realistic, in quotes, that they don't do what Hashem wants us to do. And Yaakov did do what Hashem wanted. Yaakov went back despite the danger. He goes back. And that's the second part of the parasha that we're going to discuss. Yaakov then meets Esav. He confronts the danger head on. Esav is coming after him with at least 400 armed soldiers. They're coming after him and his family and the people that he was with in his entourage. Yaakov's entourage, because they're coming from Haran to Eretz Yisrael. Yaakov, his brother, wants to murder him. And Esav wants to murder Yaakov, Yaakov's brother. Esav wants to murder Yaakov and wants to murder his family. And so he's coming with 400 armed soldiers and on horseback to do it. And Yaakov meets with him and tries to appease him, and first sends him gifts and is really very nice and almost apologetic to him. And the rabbis, Chazal, are actually critical of Yaakov for being so nice and so appeasing. Even though it was Esav's original intention to murder Yaakov, nevertheless, the rabbis say that Hashem would not have allowed that to happen, so he shouldn't have been so appeasing. So they're critical of Yaakov for being too appeasing in that meeting that he has with Esav, because he eventually meets with Esav, and Esav decides not to murder him, and they make up, in quotes, not really make up, because later Esav will again become the enemy and will again want to destroy Yaakov as he has tried to do throughout history. Esav, by the way, represents the Western world, represents Rome, and eventually from Rome, the Western world. Rome and Greece and all of the Western, all Western culture and the Western world, because there's a clash between the materialistic culture of the Western world, the hedonistic, materialistic, selfish culture of the Western world versus the Torah Jewish view. The Torah Jewish view is that true paradise is in a world where everybody gives. And even if you take just to survive or to get by, you're only taking so that you could eventually give more to the world. It's Judaism is a world of idealism. It's a world of belief in Hashem, belief in His commandments. And it's a world where we believe that if everybody would give, and if everybody would be idealistic, then the world would be paradise, and that day will come when we're going to have a world like that, where everybody will be giving, and everybody will be idealistic, and there'll be no more of the evil that we see in the world today. Whereas the Western concepts, if you watch television or Hollywood or the other filth that you have in the Western world today, the Western concepts are just materialism and selfishness and pettiness and ego and arrogance. In any event, Esav represents those concepts, the concepts of Rome and Rome's successors throughout history, whereas Yaakov represents the Jewish world and the Torah Jewish view. But even though there was some appeasement there and there's some criticism of Yaakov's attitude with Esav in that meeting, nevertheless, one thing Yaakov did not compromise. Esav in the end says, let's go together, we can live together, let's be brothers now. After all, we are brothers. Let's live together, let's work together. Yaakov says, no, you go your way, I'll go my way. And he gives a nice excuse and nice reasons for it. You know, I have tender young children and you have big soldiers. And besides, you have so many... You have such massive wealth, and I have such massive wealth, there's not enough room for the two of us in the same place. He gave all types of reasons, but in the end, he was uncompromising. We have to completely separate. You go your way, I go my way. You live with your people, I live with my people. Separate. Everything separate. And that is the Jewish view. We're not supposed to coexist with evil. We're not supposed to coexist with idolatry. We're not supposed to coexist with our enemies. In the land of Israel, we have millions of Arab Muslims that want to destroy Israel. We're not allowed to coexist with them. We should do everything we can to get them out. That's the Jewish view. And Yaakov represents that Jewish view. And you see that over and over again represented in the Torah and in the Tanakh, that we don't coexist with the evil. We don't coexist with evildoers. We don't coexist with immoral and cruel and vicious people. Because if we do, that means we're accepting. We're in effect accepting and justifying their evil behavior. And that makes us, that we begin to become evil. God forbid. And so, there'll be no assimilation and no coexistence with idolatry or evil or with cruel people. Yaakov doesn't accept it. In fact, in the end, Esav says, well, let me at least send a small entourage of soldiers with you. At least a small little group to protect you and guard you as you go. Even that Yaakov rejects. He says, no, no, no. He says, we have young children and your soldiers will travel too fast and it'll be a burden and it won't be comfortable. And no, no, no. You go your way, we'll go our way. He doesn't want any coexistence, any contact. He doesn't want it. He wants separation from evildoers. And so that's an interesting part of this, and it should be a guide to the leaders of Israel about what should be done in Israel. If that's true, if it was true then it certainly should be true for Arab Muslims that say they're going to push the Jews into the sea and finish Hitler's job and have already massacred tens of thousands of Jews since the creation of Israel in 1948 and have massacred millions of their own people. If that's what they do to each other, we know they're not joking when they promise they're going to do it to the Jews. And hopefully we're going to discuss an example of that with the Sinai Mosque massacre after we finish talking about the parasha. The third part of the parasha that we want to discuss is Dinah. Because Yaakov had 12 sons and he had one daughter. So he had 13 children altogether. He had 12 sons, he had one daughter, Dinah. Dinah, they went to Shechem, and Dinah went out in the city and decided she wanted some fresh air. She wanted to walk a little bit. She went out to walk a little bit. Big mistake. She was kidnapped and raped by Shechem. Shechem raped and kidnapped and raped. Shechem and his father were the people running the city. And they kidnapped and raped her. And then Shechem fell in love with her after he raped her. Oh, how wonderful. But anyway, he then goes to Yaakov and his sons and says, look, I have your daughter. I want to marry her. Please let me marry her. This is the rapist going and saying he wants to marry the daughter. And the sons dishonestly pretend to agree. They're not going to let her. They're not going to let their sister marry this vile rapist. But they say, you know, they pretend to agree. And they say, but there's a condition. On one condition, we're all circumcised. We all have brit hamila. We have a circumcised. You'll have to circumcise yourself and everybody in your city if you want, and then we'll all live together as brothers. That's fine. But you first have to circumcise yourself and everybody else in your city. Shechem agrees to it. Shechem and his father, who are the rulers of the city, agree to it. They go to all the residents of the city and they say to them, everybody's got to get circumcised. So the people in the city are like, wow. that's a painful surgery for in those days. You know, now we have anesthesia. We can put people to sleep. In those days, they didn't have the all the techniques of modern medicine. And when we do it, when Jews do it with their, you know, they circumcise for an eight-day-old baby, they do it when their babies are 8 days old. When an eight-day-old baby, it is not that painful. It is painful, but not that painful. But for a grown man, it's very painful. Especially if you don't have the proper anesthesia. I mean, in those days, they used liquor and they used other things to try to reduce the pain. They did have their own techniques. But still, painful, difficult operation. But Shechem and his father told the residents of the city, obviously told the residents of the city, look, these are very wealthy people. Look at all their wealth. Look at all their cattle, all the other stuff they're bringing in here. These are wealthy people. They're going to bring tremendous blessings to us. And they're very smart and ingenious. And, you know, they'll bring tremendous blessings. We'll have tremendous wealth and prosperity. Let's do this so that we all will all prosper from this. Let's do this for this, for our future and for the future of our city. So they agree. They all get circumcised. They all do the milah. They all get circumcised. And the third day after this circumcision, if it's done the old-fashioned way, without anesthesia, in other words, with just liquor or whatever else they used to dull the pain in those days, if it's done the third way, if it's done the traditional way, on the third day is the most painful. The third day is the most debilitating, the most painful. That's the peak of the pain. And so on the third day, Shimon and Levi, two of Yaakov's sons, Yaakov's 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel, by the way. Shimon and Levi were two of, eventually became the two tribes. They were two of his sons. They went out when the residents had all been circumcised and were all helpless. I mean, they were so, I mean, just in terrible pain and helpless. They went out and they massacred everybody in the city. They slaughtered everybody in that city. Now, you may ask, why'd they slaughter everybody in the city? It was only Shechem, the ruler, the son's ruler, who raped Dinah, because the people in the city supported what he did. They backed him up. They supported him. They didn't care. That was part of their culture, was normal to rape and kidnap and murder and do all the horrible things that they did. They were evil people. All of them were evil. And so Shimon and Levi went out and slaughtered all the residents of the city. It's called collective punishment today. Can you imagine if the Israel Defense Forces would do that to Arabs, who, if someone comes out of an Arab village where we know that everybody in the Arab village is happy when they carry out terrorist attacks against the Jews. Imagine if everybody in that village was slaughtered after that. Oh, that would be quite a deterrent. Nobody touched, you know, Yaakov was very nervous and very upset after this happened, and he reprimanded his sons for doing it. On moral grounds, he didn't. He didn't find anything morally wrong with it, Yaakov. He did it on practical grounds. He said, you're making enemies, we're going to make enemies. And you know, he was worried about the implications of what they had done. They slaughtered a whole city. But the opposite of what Yaakov feared occurred. Everybody was terrified of them at that point. Nobody touched them again. That was the last time anybody ever touched a Jew in the land in that generation after that. It's a good moral lesson also for the Jews in Israel to teach evil people. Anyway, so that's our parasha for this week. That's our commentary on our parasha for this week. Let's see how long did it go. Almost 26 minutes. Well, let's go into the other subjects this week. This week, at least 305 Muslims were slaughtered by their fellow Muslims, by Muslim terrorists at a mosque in the Sinai. And this is just the latest example. In the Iran-Iraq war, over 2 million Muslims were massacred by their fellow Muslims. It was a Holocaust in the 1980s in the Iran-Iraq war. Over 2 million Muslims slaughtered by their fellow Muslims. The Iraqi Muslims under Saddam Hussein used poison gas. The Iranian Muslims had six-year-old boys charging into Iraqi artillery with Qurans, holding Qurans, and they threw six-year-old boys charging. They didn't charge into the artillery, but they sent six-year-old boys to charge into the artillery, those filthy, hypocritical cowards. In any event, over 2 million people were killed just in that war. A Holocaust. It was a Holocaust. In the Syrian civil war, roughly 1 million people have been killed already. Muslims slaughtering other Muslims. And I could go on and on giving you many other examples. In Pakistan versus Bangladesh, the Pakistanis slaughtered 3 million Bengali Muslims. A Pakistani Muslim army slaughtered 3 million Bengali Muslims because there was a revolt between Pakistan. Bangladesh wanted independence from Pakistan. Millions and millions of Muslims have been annihilated by their fellow Muslims in holocausts in the Muslim world. If this is what they do to each other, what do you think they would do to us if they had the chance? To Jews, to Christians, to non-Muslim infidels in general? If this is what they do to their brothers and sisters, to their fellow Muslims, what would they do to the hated non-Muslim infidels if they had the chance? You think they're joking when they say they're going to exterminate all non-Muslim infidels? You think they're kidding? You think they're kidding when they say they're going to push Israel into the sea and wipe Israel off the face of the earth and finish Hitler's job and all the other things that they say every day in the Muslim news media about Israel? You think they're joking when they say they want to destroy the United States? Whether or not they can do it, they can actually do it or not is not the issue. The point is they want to do it. That's for sure. They certainly want to do it. And if they get their hands on nuclear bombs, there's a great danger. That there's a great danger of a terrorist nuclear holocaust. I mean, that's a real danger. They really mean it. They really mean it. So it's something we should learn. And we did a video in Hebrew, by the way, warning the people of Israel. We did a video on this subject in Hebrew. We're doing numerous Hebrew videos and advertising it. If you want us to reach the people of Israel with the great messages you're hearing through this movement, if you want us to reach the people of Israel, almost every day we put out a new Hebrew video, almost every day. And if you want the people of Israel to hear this message and to wake up before it's too late, this is the organization to support. Support us, help us. The more you support us, the more Jews in Israel the Jews of Israel are going to get our message. And the better that is for Israel and the Jewish people. The final subject I want to discuss, let me see the time. I don't have much time. I want to discuss Ivan Demyanyuk, Ivan the Terrible, Yimash Movazichro Shem Reshaim Yirkav. May his name and memory be obliterated. May the name of the wicked rot. This vicious Ukrainian Nazi war criminal operated the gas chambers in Treblinka and in other extermination camps that the Nazis ran. The Ukrainians were fanatic supporters of the German Nazis. And Demyanyuk was one of them. Demyanyuk was convicted by the United States court twice. Gentiles in the United States court system convicted him twice. German anti-Semites in the German court system convicted him and found him guilty. He was found guilty in Germany, he was found guilty in the United States twice. He was deported to Israel after his first, after being found guilty in the first time in the United States. He was deported to Israel. And the Israeli court, there was an Israeli court with the three judges. They found him guilty. They unanimously found him guilty. Said they have no doubt, there's no question in their mind that he's guilty, that he's Ivan the Terrible, the monster. Let me tell you what Ivan the Terrible did. He murdered tens of thousands of Jews. He had a big sword on him. When Jewish women would come by, as he was pushing them into the gas chambers to exterminate them, he would cut their breasts off. In other cases, he would just stab people and cut them up as he was pushing them into the gas chambers. There was one incident in particular where they testified in the trial about a 12-year-old Jewish girl who miraculously survived the gas chamber. Everyone else died, but she was on top. She was small, so she was on top. She was 12 years old, and somehow she survived. Once in a while, you had very rare cases where once in a while someone would come out and survive. So she came out screaming and crying, "Where's my Ima? Where's my mother? Where's my mother?" She was screaming, asking for her mother. Mother, of course, was among the people murdered in the gas chamber. But she was screaming and crying and asking for her Ima, for her mother. And Demanyuk took the sword, took out his sword, started laughing when he saw her, took out his sword and cut her into pieces. That was Ivan Demanyuk. Ivan the Terrible. Those are the Nazi war criminals that the Israeli government sucks up to this day. And Jews visit Germany and visit Poland and give money to all these beasts and visit the Ukraine and give them tourist dollars and live in these countries. There's going to be a lot to answer for on Yom HaDin, on the Day of Judgment, that Jews were willing to deal with such monsters. In any event, he's convicted by the Israeli court, and the Israeli court sentences him to death. There were 13 Holocaust survivors who were witnesses, who said they saw him every day. They saw his face every day, and they never forget after what he did. He murdered their whole family. They saw their entire family slaughtered by him. So they never forget what he looked like. And they said, they identified him. They said they're absolutely certain that it's him. No question that he's the one. 13 Holocaust survivors identified him. One of the German Nazis themselves, who was on trial in Germany, they went to Germany, took testimony in Germany from him, the Israeli court, and he identified him. One of his fellow German Nazi, even the German Nazi war criminal, identified him and said, "Oh, absolutely, that was him. There's no question that was him. There's no doubt it was him." Unless you think 13 Holocaust survivors were all lying. In any event, the Israeli Supreme Court then gets the case on appeal and overturns his conviction and frees him. To prove how fair we are, how wonderful, we're going to find some reason to free him, because we're going to show even the worst butchers of Jewish children and Jewish babies, we're going to free them to show the world. You see? You see how enlightened we are? You see how wonderful we are? The Israeli Supreme Court, Yimach Shmam V'Zichram, Shem Rashaim Yirkav, they should burn in hell, deeper in hell than the Nazi war criminals that they free. They should be deeper in hell, the Israeli Supreme Court, than Demanyuk is. Demanyuk is dead already. He's already burning in hell. They should be deeper in hell and suffer even more pain and agony forever and ever than Demanyuk is suffering, because they're doing it to their own people. That's even worse than some Ukrainian or Pole or German Nazi doing this type of atrocity. When they do it to their own people, their own brothers and sisters, that's even worse. They freed him. They cut him loose and freed him. And eventually he's retried in the United States again and again, found guilty, and then sent to Germany and found guilty in Germany of the war crimes. I mean, there's no question this guy was guilty. There's no question. But this is the type of scum we have controlling Israel's institutions and Israel's establishment, the Supreme Court, the government, the news media, all left-wing, self-hating, Judenrat, capo, filth, the lowest of the low, the lowest of the low, who will work with our worst enemies. And we did a video, of course, on the Demanio case as well, a Hebrew video to expose this as well. So these are some of the things we're bringing to the people of Israel. When you help us, you're helping the people of Israel see a truth that no one else tells them. We have to work, we're obligated to work to make this a better world, to expose the truth, to fight for what's right, to fight for justice and truth and righteousness. We're obligated to do that. Someday, the forces of good will win. Someday that will happen. That we're promised, that's for sure. But before that happens, in the end of days, we're going to have unbelievable evil, which is what we're seeing today. And even when we have that unbelievable evil, we must stand up and fight for righteousness and fight for truth and justice. You can be part of that fight. You can be part of that group of people who won't sit back in silence and won't watch injustice by supporting JTF. It's worth doing. As much as JTF does for you, for the Jewish people, as much as you would do for JTF, JTF actually does more for you by giving you a reason to say to Hashem on Yom HaDin, I did have a purpose in life. I helped awaken people at a time when no one else was telling the truth. That'll be a very powerful argument when the time comes. For JTF, until next week, this is Chaim Ben Pesach. Shalom.